This week, controversy struck the World Scrabble Championships in Warsaw when one player accused another of cheating. The competition has been known to get vicious, but the incident brought to light just how far some players will go to ensure a fair match. In this case, the accusations came with some pretty unusual demands, and the flap has longtime Scrabble enthusiast Meg Wolitzer worried.
Did you hear the news? The letter G went missing during the last draw of a match at the World Scrabble Championships in Warsaw, and nothing will ever be the same. A player from Thailand insisted that his British opponent be strip-searched in order to find that rogue consonant, but the authorities refused. So what's going on here? Is Scrabble becoming like every other major sport? Is my favorite game headed for a kind of word-related Barry Bonds, Lance Armstrong future? Because frankly, that's a future I don't want to live in. I first started playing Scrabble when I was a kid. My mother and I would take our old maroon set to the beach and make our simple, sweet words. I still have it, and there are all these oil spots on the cover from an ancient tube of Bain de Soleil. We didn't know from anything back then. We didn't know that there were Q words in Scrabble that didn't take a U, or that AA was good and FE was an ironclad option. We proudly made words like friend or hat. But maybe a new precedent has been set, and Scrabble players are going to start accusing each other of all sorts of things. Like, they'll say their opponents are wearing special lenses, the kind they used to sell in the back of Archie comics that allow you to see under a woman's dress. Or in this case, right into the word rack of your opponent. All players will have to take mandatory urine tests. Dictionaries, after they've been thumbed through, will be checked for trace elements of a special lexicographical steroid. Coaches will be fired. Countries will trade players. Timers will have to be studied to make sure that one player's side doesn't move ahead slowly while the other player's side doesn't race ahead like the meter of a corrupt New York cabbie. The undersides of all tables will be checked to make sure there isn't any gum there to which a letter could conveniently adhere. People will make millions. It's all going to explode. I know this isn't the first time there have been accusations of cheating in a game where you don't have to wear gym shorts or a cup, but this incident has certainly gotten the most attention, and I fear that it's not only Scrabble that's going to change. Look out, pickup sticks. You're not safe either.
Meg Wolitzer is the author of the young adult book The Fingertips of Duncan Dorfman, about kids who meet at a Scrabble tournament. The World Scrabble Championships wrapped up on Sunday. First prize went to a player from New Zealand who won with the 96-point word omnified. You can comment on this and other essays at our website. Just go to npr.org and click on Opinion.
You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
NPR's Sylvia Pagioli is in Athens, and she joins us on the line for a look at what the strike is looking like there. Good morning, Sylvia.
Good morning, Renee.
What's the scene there? Pretty quiet, I imagine.
It's very quiet. There are no buses, taxis. All flights have been canceled. State offices, shops, even bakeries are shut down. This mother of all strikes is the first 48-hour general strike in, I think, two decades. And it follows weeks of walkouts in many sectors, from judges to journalists, school teachers to garbage collectors. There are piles of garbage everywhere in Athens. The walkout started about 2 weeks ago. And to give you a sense of the anger and how fed up Greeks are with the austerity measures, a garbage strike of this scope some years ago would have triggered fury at the strikers. Today, even though the health ministry has warned of the dangers for public health, there's a very strong sense of solidarity with the garbage collectors.
But as we just heard, Sylvia, tomorrow the Greek parliament will vote on this new austerity package. It includes more wage and job cuts, higher taxes, and a watering down of national collective bargaining in the private sector. Is there any chance that this new austerity package will not pass?
Well, some lawmakers of the ruling socialists are reportedly wavering. Last night, Prime Minister George Papandreou made a final appeal to them. He also met with the leader of the conservative opposition. But Antonis Samaras said, no way, we're not going to vote for these measures because they are undermining economic growth. The ruling socialists are way down in the polls. Government officials are increasingly isolated from society. Civil servants have taken over several government buildings. Even the finance minister, Evangelos Venizelos, has been unable to get into his office for the last 2 weeks. And leaflets pasted to the wall of the building say, the massacre of our wages will be the nightmare of bankers. And yet most analysts believe the measures will pass. The problem will be implementing them.
And all of this, of course, is about Greece not defaulting on its massive debt. European leaders will be meeting next weekend again to try and resolve the crisis. Can they really solve it?
Well, that's the big question being asked in financial markets. This will be the EU leaders' sixth attempt this year to come up with what they keep calling a comprehensive solution. They're expected to announce whether Greece will get the next installment of the $150 billion bailout that was agreed to last year. They're supposed to talk about recapitalization of some major European banks and whether the new rescue fund that they have finally cobbled together will be increased to as much as $2 trillion. But all the leaders do up to now is send mixed signals. At one moment, it appears France and Germany are on the verge of agreement. Then German Chancellor Angela Merkel says, do not expect a miracle cure. Then we hear French President Nicolas Sarkozy warning ominously, those who destroy Europe and the euro will bear responsibility for resurgence of conflict and divisions on our continent. That's pretty heavy stuff, and yet nothing concrete is coming out.
And in the middle of all of that back and forth, the Greek crisis is becoming contagious.
That's the nightmare in European capitals. Yesterday, the rating agency Moody's warned of a possible downgrade of France's credit rating. And after that, Moody cut Spain's credit rating by two notches. The other big rating agency, Standard & Poor's, cut the ratings of 24 Italian banks and financial institutions, citing weaker growth prospects and tighter credit conditions. Moody's assessment was very gloomy. It said no credible solution of the sovereign debt crisis has emerged, and it will take time to fully restore confidence in the eurozone's political cohesion and growth prospects. With rumors flying and credit ratings downgraded, the atmosphere is feverish, the debt crisis seems to be spreading, there's a sense of greater urgency, and yet European leaders continue to dither.
Sylvia, thanks very much.
Thank you, Renee.
NPR's Sylvia Poggioli speaking to us from Athens.
Now, a story about a literary honor bestowed, then, oops, taken away. Last week, the National Book Foundation announced its finalists for the National Book Awards, and among the finalists for young people's literature was the young adult novel titled Shine. But it turns out there was a communication mistake. The judges had actually meant to nominate the young adult novel Chime. That's Shine versus Chime. The judges had read the list of finalists over the phone, and apparently the foundation heard Shine instead of Chime. Well, joining us to help untangle the tale is the author of Shine, Lauren Miracle. And Lauren, the finalists were announced last Wednesday. Your name was on that list. How long did your euphoria last?
Well, I got a call on Monday, so the Monday before Wednesday, from the National Book Foundation, in which I was told that I was a finalist, and I said, you're kidding me. And he said, that's not usually the response we get, but yes, I'm not kidding you. And I said, are you sure? Do you know who you're talking to? And he said, is this Lauren Miracle? Yes. Did you write Shine? Yes. Then congratulations, my dear, you are a finalist. And I was like, woo! So I had 2 days of complete exultation, although I wasn't allowed to tell anybody about it. And then on Wednesday, when they did the announcement live, oh, man, that was so awesome for all of 2 hours.
2 hours. And then things turned around when you heard that actually you were included on the list by mistake.
Yeah, I didn't hear that at first. What I heard was a very sweet journalist who was interviewing me at the time said, "So what's up with this shine chime confusion?" And my stomach fell, you know, out of my body and onto the floor. And so I got on the internet and, yes, saw at that time a sixth finalist has been named. There was some miscommunication, but all books are worthy and the judges unanimously want to keep them all on the list. And hooray.
So here's what happened. The National Book Foundation added the book that they originally intended to nominate. That's a book called Chime by Franny Billingsley. Kept your book, Shine, on the list too, but then changed their mind, said you shouldn't be a finalist, and in the end essentially asked you to take yourself off the list. How did you decide that that was the right thing to do?
Well, I went from exultation to devastation to weep, 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 and weep some more. And then pull myself up from my, bootstraps and put on my big girl panties and say, you know what? it's time to get some resolution. And at that point, it did seem like the right thing to do was to say, they want me off. You got it. I'm off. Let's try to make something good come out of this.
And how did you make something good come out of it?
Well, they had very graciously invited me to come to the party anyway, and I felt like, no, thank you. I don't want to be the one sitting there saying, hello, I'm the one who didn't get nominated. So I said, how about we do a donation to the Matthew Shepard Foundation instead? And they jumped on it and said, yes, ma'am. And the book Shine deals with a gay teenager and a hate crime. And so for resources to be given to a foundation that works on protecting the integrity of young people and works on promoting tolerance over hate, that's pretty cool, you know?
We should explain here that Matthew Shepard was the college student who died in 1998, who was the victim of a notorious anti-gay hate crime.
Yeah, and I live in Fort Collins, Colorado. I grew up in the South, but I live in Colorado now, and Matthew Shepard was attacked about an hour away from where I live in Wyoming. And so this was a very big deal in my town and in my heart and in my soul. And Matthew Shepard was somebody that I was thinking about constantly when I wrote Shine. So I thought that was a really beautiful way to at least honor that aspect of the situation.
I've been talking with Lauren Miracle. She's the author of the young adult novel Shine, which was mistakenly put on the list of finalists for a National Book Award. Lauren, thanks very much.
Thank you, Melissa. You rock.
And the National Book Foundation is promising to include new safeguards in its nominating process to avoid mix-ups in the future.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. Many protesters who are a part of Occupy Wall Street say they're upset about the rising price of college. Tuition and other costs have been increasing faster than inflation, and family incomes can't keep up. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, there's little sign these costs will drop anytime soon.
If you are a veteran of a public university like I am, the jump in tuition at your alma mater might be downright jaw-dropping. My parents paid UC Berkeley about $700 a year back in the 1970s. Today, they would have to fork over around $15,000 per annum. That's a 2,000% increase. There's a simple explanation.
States are paying less of the cost than they used to.
Sandy Baum teaches at George Washington University. She says that as state budgets shrink, the student share of education goes up.
They are now subsidizing students less than they used to. Students are paying more of the cost.
Berkeley's tuition increase is unusually large, but many public schools, which educate 80% of all students in this country, have seen dramatic increases. Private schools don't rely on state subsidies, and their prices have gone up more slowly in recent years, but they're still rising faster than inflation. Terry Hartle of the American Council on Education says that's because schools are paying more for talent.
Now we're competing in a global economy. So if you want to get the best scientists, the best engineers, the best information technology specialists, you're literally competing with universities and employers around the globe.
Not to mention the higher cost for health insurance for all those expensive faculty and counseling services, which are expanding. But even as sticker prices climb, student aid has also gone up dramatically. Sandy Baum says for students in private schools, more aid just about cancels out tuition increases over the past 5 years.
So yes, the colleges are charging more than they used to, but not a lot more than they used to after adjusting for inflation.
Baum says one reason why tuition never seems to drop is that universities are not getting more efficient the way other industries are. Some conservative governors are pushing administrators to cut waste and to make professors more productive. Richard Vedder of the Center for College Affordability and Productivity says the more government aid goes up, the more tuition rises. He believes limits on grants and loan subsidies would cap spiraling tuition prices.
And that reduces the demand for college, and that is going to tend to have a depressing effect on the ability of colleges to raise tuition fees.
Many economists question that link. So does Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, who has pushed for more college aid for low-income students.
We've sort of done a number of, statistical and historical analysis there, but that actually doesn't seem to be based in reality.
In fact, Duncan and others argue the problem is that grant aid hasn't risen fast enough. Lauren Asher is with the Institute for College Access and Success in California.
Today, a federal Pell Grant covers only about a third of what it costs to go to a public four-year college in-state. In the 1980s, it covered half. In the 1970s, it covered more than 70%.
The problem is compounded because people today are less able to pay. Incomes are stagnant, and some parents are unemployed. Many can no longer get low-interest home equity loans because home values have fallen. So families have turned to federal student loans, and even, Lauren Asher says, much more expensive private loans.
Private student loans are much riskier than federal student loans because they don't come with the important repayment plans, forgiveness programs, and other borrower protections that federal loans provide.
The Obama administration has been rolling out a number of measures to help students in danger of falling behind on their federal loan payments. Nearly 500,000 students have signed up for income-based repayment. It limits the portion of your income that you have to pay. More students could be signing up for this program. It might be the best option while students wait for the economy to pick up. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Not only are protesters occupying Zuccotti Park, they're also using a lot of space on Twitter and other social media sites. One of the hottest properties is Livestream, where visitors can watch live footage from the Occupy Wall Street protests. Nina Porzucchi of Turnstile News has that story.
In the middle of the frenzy at Zuccotti Park, under a giant pink umbrella, protesters hover over laptops surrounded by mounds of equipment covered in blue tarps. A beaten-up sign rests at their feet, the word media written in magic marker. This is the Occupy Wall Street media headquarters.
We have people that monitor social media, such as Twitter and Facebook, people that monitor the news, people that live stream. That's a huge thing, actually, because that's how we get a lot of our news out to our followers.
That's Colin Laws. He's 19, from Connecticut, and a week ago, he was one of those live stream followers, watching the streaming video of Zuccotti Park over the internet. And then after weeks of just watching The Global Revolution, that's the name of the live stream channel, he sold his TV and all of his video games and bought a bus ticket to New York. What really brought him out to the protest?
Seeing Hero and all the other people on live stream, it ended up having me come down here to help out with media.
Yo, what's up, everybody? This is Hero V.
Hero Vincent. Yes, that's his name. Is a protester turned live stream broadcaster turned icon. Here's a clip from the live stream last Friday, right after the city announced it would not evacuate protesters to clean the park.
We are at a beautiful moment right now. There's thousands of people out here, as you can see. And we're all standing in solidarity. I'm losing my voice again, unfortunately.
If the live stream has a news anchor, I suppose he's it. But news anchor is not his formal role. There are no formal roles or any formal schedule. The Occupy media is as loose as the protest itself.
It just happens. Like, I'm comfortable in front of the camera because I'm a performer. So, like, getting in front of the camera trying to inspire people to do stuff is just who I am.
Vincent never wanted to be a journalist, if that's what he is. His live stream fame is just a byproduct of what he really came down on day one to talk about.
You know, like, my family has been foreclosed on. You know, my father's been unemployed a couple of years now, and my sister's in school with high tuition, and it's just been a long time coming. We've been working hard. I've been working since I was 14 just to help my parents, you know, put food on the table, so it was inevitable for me to be here.
But for other members of the Occupy Wall Street Press Corps, this may be a jumpstart into another career in, well, media. Luke Richardson works on the live stream.
What do I do? We all do the same thing here. We shoot, we edit, we charge batteries, we put up tarps when it rains, we keep people from stealing our equipment. It's constant work.
What is your experience before?
I'm a waiter.
Or he was a waiter. 4 days into protesting, he quit his job. We didn't get into the ironies of quitting work to protest unemployment. Richardson says this might be career advancement, just a career he had never considered before.
I've been thinking about it a lot, how I can parlay this into some way to sustain myself, because I do have bills to pay, and I love this, and I want to keep doing it.
Richardson is not alone. Several members of the media team, from an antique dealer to an English master student, are suddenly reconsidering their future careers. Remember Colin Laws, who sold his TV to get to New York? Well, Hero Vincent wasn't the only reason he left Connecticut.
Another reason I came down here was because I'm looking to become a journalist, and I was going to go to school for it, but this was going on, and I did not want to wait. I wanted to get down here.
Not only have Occupy Wall Street demonstrations spread from city to city, live streams of the protest have caught on around the world. You can now watch demonstrations from Los Angeles to London. For NPR News, I'm Nina Porzucki.
And that story was produced by TurnstileNews.com. That's an online news service from Youth Radio.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.